We're continuing Chapter 5 of Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. So if you remember, they were flying in the car to Hogwarts. Several hours later, however, Harry had to admit that some of the fun was wearing off. The toffees had made them extremely thirsty, and they had nothing to drink. He and Ron had pulled off their sweaters, but Harry's t-shirt was sticking to the back of his seat, and his glasses kept sliding down to the end of his sweaty nose. He had stopped noticing the fantastic cloud shapes now, and was thinking longingly of the train miles below where you could buy ice-cold pumpkin juice from a trolley pushed by a pump witch. Why pumpkin juice? How gross is that? I like pumpkin, and pumpkin juice does not sound appealing to me.
Well, like, when you're little, you don't have a concept of, like, pumpkin juice being, like, bitter.
Yeah.
You think of it being, like, oh, sweet, because pumpkin pie is sweet.
Right.
Anything that you eat with pumpkin in it, you associate with sweetness.
Yeah.
So you kind of associate it with being, like, on more of a savory scale, like pumpkin pie.
Yeah. I think, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
I think people associate it, pumpkin with more like nutmeg and sugar than actual pumpkin.
And like,
maybe like a hint of the pumpkin flavor, but.
Well, and I think that like in your head when you're like, well, pumpkin juice, you kind of make up. It's not so much the nutmeg, but you like make up this flavor for what you think it would be. So like you think, okay, orange. So pumpkin juice is obviously going to be orange.
Obviously.
Okay. Number two, you definitely think it's going to be sweet.
Yeah.
And number three, you think it's probably going to be, like, fresh, but not, like, as acidic as orange juice.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But it's not going to have those spices. Like, you know it's not going to have those spices that pumpkin pie has, but it's still, like, still sounds good.
Yeah. I suppose. I guess it's also, like, a witch thing to do. But
think about what sweet potatoes taste like when they're baked. With no, like, flavors on them. You know how they're, like, sweet?
Yeah.
And kind of have, like, that, like...
Yeah.
It's not acidic, like, citric acid, but it's, like... Savory is the wrong word. It's, like, I don't know. We'll have to find a new word for it.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I used to picture pumpkin juice tasting.
That's really interesting. I don't think I ever thought about what pumpkin juice would taste like, but now that I'm, you know, when I'm reading it now, I don't think it would taste very good.
Because you're 29.
Because I'm an old man.
Right.
Exactly. Anyways, shall we continue? Why hadn't they been able to get on platform 9 3/4? Can't be much further, can it? Croaked Ron, hours later still, as the sun started to sink into their floor of the cloud, staining it a deep pink. Ready for another check on the train? It was still right below them, winding its way past a snow-capped mountain. It was much darker beneath the canopy of clouds. Ron put his foot on the accelerator and drove them upward again, but as he did so, the engine began to whine. Harry and Ron exchanged nervous glances. "It's probably just tired," said Ron. "It's never been this far before." And they pretended not to notice the whining growing louder and louder as the sky became steadily darker. Stars were blossoming in the blackness. Harry pulled his sweater back on, trying to ignore the way the windshield wipers were now waving feebly, as though in protest. "Not far," said Ron, more to the car than to Harry. "Not far now," and he patted the dashboard nervously. When they flew back beneath the clouds a little while longer, they had to squint through the darkness for a landmark they knew. "There," Harry shouted, making Ron and Hedwig jump. "Straight ahead." Silhouetted on the dark horizon, high on the cliff over the lake, stood the many turrets and towers of Hogwarts Castle. But the car had begun to shudder and was losing speed. "Come on," Ron said cajolingly, giving the steering wheel a little shake. "Nearly there, come on." The engine groaned. Narrow jets of steam were issuing from under the hood. Harry found himself gripping the edge of his seat very hard as they flew toward the lake. The car gave a nasty wobble. Glancing out of his window, Harry saw the smooth, black, glassy surface of the water a mile below. Ron's knuckles were white on the steering wheel. The car wobbled again. "Come on," Ron muttered. They were over the lake. Castle was right ahead. Ron put his foot down. There was a loud clunk, a sputter, and the engine died completely. "Uh-oh," said Ron into the silence. The nose of the car dropped. They were falling, gathering speed, heading straight for the solid castle wall. "No," Ron yelled, swinging the steering wheel around. They missed the dark stone wall by inches as the car turned in a great arc, soaring over the dark greenhouses and then the vegetable patch, and then out over the black lawns, losing altitude all the time. Ron let go of the steering wheel completely and pulled his wand out of his back pocket.
"I have to be you for a minute."
"What?"
"If the engine was dead, how could he steer?"
"Right. It's a magical car." "I mean, how does..."
"But I don't understand the magic."
"How does putting his foot down make the car go in the air?"
"Well, like, I get it."
"Also, while we're on the subject..." "What's that?"
"Like a plane."
But it turns the wheels. A plane...
"But this isn't physics. Think of it like, okay, you're giving it more magical juice. So like that, just like..."
"Right, I suppose. But then steering is independent of the engine, right? Steering makes it turn."
"Fair enough, okay. I see your point." "And hers."
But also...
"They stuck up for J.K. Rowling, babe."
"I know, I saw that. But also, just earlier, they were over the lake, a mile over the lake. You know how far a mile is vertically?"
I am aware.
Now they're, like, nearly running into the castle.
They wouldn't have been able to see Hogwarts."
"Yeah. Anyways, Ron let go of the steering wheel completely and pulled his wand out of his back pocket. "Stop! Stop!" he yelled. Whacking the dashboard and the windshield. They were still plummeting, the ground flying up toward them. "Watch out for that tree," Harry bellowed, lurching for the steering wheel, but too late. Crunch. With an ear-splitting bang of metal on wood, they hit the thick tree trunk and dropped to the ground with a heavy jolt. Steam was billowing from under the crumpled hood. Hedwig was shrieking in terror. A golf ball-sized lump was throbbing on Harry's head where he hit the windshield, and to his right, Ron let out a low, despairing groan. "Are you okay?" Harry said urgently. "My wand," said Ron in a shaky voice. "Look at my wand." It had snapped, almost in two. The tip was dangling limply, held on by a few splinters. Harry opened up his mouth to say he was sure they'd be able to mend it up at the school, but he never even got started. At that very moment, something hit his side of the car with the force of a charging bull, sending him lurching sideways into Ron, just as an equally heavy blow hit the roof. "What's happened?" Ron gasped, staring through the windshield. And Harry looked around just in time to see a branch as thick as a python smash into it. The tree they had hit was attacking them. Its trunk was bent almost double, and its gnarled boughs were pummeling every inch of the car it could reach. "Ah!" Ron yelled, as another twisted limb punched a large dent in his door. The windshield was now trembling under the hail of blows from knuckle-like twigs, and a branch as thick as a battering ram was pounding furiously on the roof, which seemed to be caving. "Run for it!" Ron shouted, throwing his full weight against his door, but the next second he'd been knocked backward into Harry's lap by a vicious uppercut from another branch. "We're done for," he moaned, as the ceiling sagged, but suddenly the floor of the car was vibrating. The engine had restarted. "Reverse!" Harry yelled, and the car shot backward. The tree was still trying to hit them. They could hear its roots creaking as it almost ripped itself, lashing at them as they sped out of reach. "That," panted Ron, "was close. Well done, car." The car, however, had reached the end of its tether. With two sharp clunks, the door flew open, and Harry felt his seat tip sideways out. Next thing he knew, he was sprawled on the damp ground. Loud thuds told him that the car was ejecting their luggage from the trunk. Hedwig's cage flew through the air and burst open. She rose out of it with an angry screech and sped off toward the castle without a backwards look. Then, dented, scratched, and steaming, the car rumbled off into the darkness, its rear lights blazing angrily. "Come back!" Ron yelled after it, brandishing his broken wand. "Dad'll kill me!" But the car had disappeared from view with one last snort from its exhaust. "Can you believe our luck?" said Ron miserably, bending down to pick up Scabbers. "Of all the trees we could have hit, we had to hit the one that hits back." He glanced over his shoulder at the ancient tree, which was still flailing over its branches threateningly. "Come on," Harry said wearily. "We better get up to the school." It wasn't at all the triumphant arrival they had pictured. Stiff, cold, and bruised, they seized the ends of their trunks and began dragging them up the grassy slopes toward the great oak front doors. "I think the feast's already started," said Ron, dropping his trunk at the foot of the front steps and crossing quietly to look through the brightly lit window. "Hey, Harry, come and look. It's the sorting." Harry hurried over, and together he and Ron peered in at the great hall. Innumerable candles were hovering over, in midair, over four long crowded tables, making golden plates and goblets sparkle. Overhead, the bewitched ceiling, which always mirrored the sky outside, sparkled with stars. Through the forest of pointed black Hogwarts hats, Harry saw a long line of scared-looking first-years filling into the hall. Ginny was among them, easily visible because of her vivid Weasley hair. Meanwhile, Professor McGonagall, a bespeckled witch with her hair in a tight bun, was placing the famous Hogwarts sorting hat on a stool before the newcomers. Every year, this aged old hat, patched, frayed, and dirty, sorted new students into the four Hogwarts houses. Gryffindor, the good ones, Hufflepuff, the hard-working ones, Ravenclaw, the smart ones, and Slytherin, the evil ones. Thank you. Harry well remembered putting it on exactly
do
1 year.
Right. No, we have to go back and do the right thing.
Okay, she just lists them into the four Hogwarts houses.
Now you have to say the like real defining characteristics.
But it doesn't say them. She just lists the
houses. No, you have to say them.
Gryffindor for the brave and true. Hufflepuff for those who love their friends. Ravenclaw for those wise among the words. And Slytherin, for those with ambition beyond ambition.
Okay.
Was that okay?
Sure.
Harry well remembered putting it on exactly 1 year ago and waiting, petrified. Actually, let me interrupt again. You know that I prefer the description where, like, Slytherin gets ambition as opposed to her description, which where Slytherin is basically evil. Like, I understand she tries.
Her definition is not that Slytherin is
basically evil. She tries to make
it
nuanced, but like 90% of the Slytherins are evil.
No, that's okay. No, the problem is that is like the stereotype. It's like
yeah.
Background, you know.
But she makes it a bad like. Well, what I'm thinking in particular is look at how Eliezer did it, right? He made it so that, yes, it's a stereotype, and yes, the Slytherins are often evil, but the only reason they are is because they've let their house get that way, and the house itself is really about ambition, and everyone has a little bit in them, and Harry's Slytherin side talks to him, and it's not Harry's evil side, right? He has a dark side that's separate, but his Slytherin side is the ambitious aspect. If she actually explored that more, I mean, I understand that she says that, but she never explores it. She never explores the prospect of Harry having a Slytherin side, except it being the evil side of Harry. You know? Like, Harry often worries
fair,
about
it. Okay, fair enough. In this mythology, you are right. Okay, fine.
Anyways. But I really like what Eliezer did with it, where he has the voices, you know. I think that's cool. Harry well remembered putting it on exactly 1 year ago and waiting, petrified for its decision as it muttered aloud in his ear. For a few horrible seconds, he had feared the hat was going to sort him into Slytherin, the house that had turned out more dark witches and wizards than any other. There you go. But he...
Well, Wait. Now I have a.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now I have a rebuttal to your point, which is that one of the reasons that she makes the Slytherin side like the evil side of Harry is because that is how Harry sees Slytherin. That's how Harry sees Slytherin, not how Slytherin actually is in her mythology.
Well, it's not just how, I mean, you're right, it is how Harry sees Slytherin, but it's also how, like, all the Gryffindors, and pretty much everyone at Hogwarts except for Slytherin.
That doesn't mean that that's the right thing, and I think that she does prove that point in the later books with Harry's, the development of Harry's relation, Harry's dad's relationship with Snape, and that group of guys, and how they were not necessarily the good guys, and Snape was innocent, you know.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I really appreciate that she explored the idea that sort of his dad was kind of a jerk, but nevertheless, like.
No, I think that that is actually a really good point, which is that our perceptions of things and stereotypes can color things for the good or for the bad, you know? It's like...
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I just... It feels like she does not paint as nuanced a picture of Slytherin as... Eliezer does.
Okay, but she is writing a children's book, whereas Eliezer is writing for adults.
That's true. That's a good point.
So she can't paint as nuanced a picture. She does, however, paint enough of a nuanced picture to keep the parents that are reading these to their children interested, and to keep the young adults who are reading these books interested.
Yeah, that's probably true. I think the young adults could have handled it being more nuanced, but you're right, the kids, you gotta think of the children.
I don't know. I think that it is pretty nuanced. It's some pretty hard stuff that she throws in there. Also, how much he has written, and he's not even past the first book.
Yeah, that's true. I wonder.
So you can't overly complicate things, especially when you're creating a world.
Oh, yeah, obviously.
And that nuance goes into the creation of and detail of the world itself.
Yeah.
Oh, look at us. We sound like smart people debating this. This is ridiculous.
Oh, man. Yeah. Anyway, should I continue?
Yes.
But I won. He says, you always win. But he had ended up in Gryffindor, along with Ron, Hermione, and the rest of the Weasleys. And why did Hermione end up in Gryffindor and not Ravenclaw? That's what I want to know.
Like you said, it's who asks.
It's what?
Who asks? Didn't you say that?
No.
Oh, I might have read this. I read an article that kind of sorted the houses into a different point, which was that the people in Gryffindor were the people who asked to be in Gryffindor, because that takes bravery. That is the, like, model of courage that they take, which is...
How do we know that she asked to be in Gryffindor?
This is, like, assuming that.
Oh, so this is, it's sort of like a fan fiction type thing?
Yeah, it's an outside-in article perspective on, well, what if this is the case?
I see. I don't know. I think
that on works of art like this, you're allowed to kind of superimpose your own ideas on certain things like that, and I kind of like that, because if you look at Gryffindor, it's full of, it's a hodgepodge, you know? You've got people like Peter Pettigrew, who probably should have been in Slytherin. You got people like Hermione, who should have been in Ravenclaw. People like Neville, who might have been in Hufflepuff. But the overarching theme is that they do kind of these grand gestures at some point or another.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's plausible that they could have been, like, that's the premise for getting into Gryffindor.
That's reasonable. I don't think anything in my mind will beat Eliezer's version. I think
that's different than this not being plausible in this world. you just like the deviation of the world that he created more. Well, it's more to your taste.
Yeah, it's more to my taste, but I really like it. It strikes me as the most honest in the sense that it there is no house that becomes the good house, and there is no house that becomes the evil house. Right? Like, I freely will admit that I am not a Gryffindor, right? But, like...
You've established this.
But, like, if I were in this book...
What are we again? Wait. You're Ravenclaw Hufflepuff.
Yeah.
And am I Slytherin Gryffindor or Gryffindor Slytherin?
I think you're... Yeah, that's a good question. I think you're Slytherin Gryffindor.
What?
But in the best way possible. That's what I mean. Like, not at all in the J.K. Rowling Slytherin, you know, but you are,
I'm so dissed right now.
No, you shouldn't be dissed at all. See, Slytherin is great. Like, that's why I think, I mean.
Why is it great?
Because it's all about understanding people.
No.
What do you mean?
Slytherin is not about understanding people.
Yeah, it is.
No, it's about manipulating people and ambition. Eliezer's defining point of Slytherin is not compassion. That's understanding people, compassion.
So it is ambition, sure, but it's...
He never says that the Slytherins are compassionate. None of them are compassionate in his thing.
Oh, compassion is sort of a side point. Yeah, not, he never mentions compassion for any of them.
But that's understanding people. That's what you
mean. No, but understanding people... So, you along the lines of what you said, like...
Understanding in order to manipulate them.
Right, but manipulate has... Well, but the thing is, manipulate has such a negative connotation, and I don't think that's... The connotation is the sense that we want to use it in.
I understand what you're saying, but, like...
I mean, there are two aspects.
You're saying I'm Harry, but like reversed.
What do you mean?
I'm the Harry counterpart.
You mean he's Gryffindor Slytherin and you're Slytherin Gryffindor?
Uh-huh.
Perhaps. I don't actually think... Wait, which Harry are we talking here? Harry Methods of Rationality or Harry and J.K. Rowling?
Methods of Rationality, is he in Ravenclaw?
Yeah, he's in Ravenclaw.
Okay, then never mind.
Yeah, he's definitely Ravenclaw, but he has aspects of all of them. But I think it's the aspects of you. I mean, obviously you've got a little Lyra in you, right? Which is totally Slytherin. but not just that. I think you have other aspects that make you Slytherin too. Like really positive aspects. I think the aspects of you which like genuinely just want to make people happy. I think
that's not Slytherin.
I think it is Slytherin. It's because it's not so
that's Hufflepuff.
No, I knew you were gonna say Hufflepuff. The thing is, it's not the loyalty to friends, like stick by your friends kind of thing. You have that too, obviously. But it's you want to make people happy whether or not they're your friends. You just want to make people happy. Like, there's core to you is pleasing everyone in the world. And that...
You're right. I mean, but do you think that's a Slytherin
trait? I think that's a really Slytherin quality. I think it's at least closer to Slytherin than any of the other houses. I certainly don't have it.
I don't know. I think that their depiction of Hufflepuff is more that way.
Maybe in J.K. Rowling, but not in Eliezer's version.
In Eliezer's, none of the kids try and please other people. They are very much just pleasing their own.
Sort of, except...
Like they are. I mean, it's not sort of.
Yeah, I mean, no one is super nice to, like... Lots of other people. Yeah, I
guess
you're right.
Not even within their own house are they, like, super nice.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know. For some reason, I have the sense. I mean, Because he talked about...
I think that you have super... That's you doing what we're talking about, which is, like, super important.
Yeah, you might be right. Yeah. I don't know.
Which is fine. That's totally fine.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going off of the discussion of, you know, Slytherins know how to understand people, like, which he does talk about.
Right.
And I always took that... I thought that Harry points out to Draco that, you know, just because you use, he definitely says stuff like this, where he's like, so Harry is using some fact about someone. He learns something about someone in order to make them, in order to do something nice. And Draco's like, so how are you going to use that information, like, sneakily, you know? And Harry's like, well, I'm going to use it to help them, right? And that I think is Draco understands that he's very good at trying to learn about other people.
But that's a Harry trait, not a Draco trait.
What's that?
That was a Harry trait, not a Draco trait.
Yes, it's a Harry trait. Draco understands that he's really good at this ability, but he's been so brainwashed, you know, by his dad and stuff.
No, I don't think that that's a brainwashing thing. I think that, again, it's like you have these inherent traits, and that's what this premise is. Like,
maybe. I don't think... I don't know. I don't know.
Because I don't think that Draco's dad, like, wants him to be unkind in the Eliezer book.
No, but he wants him to do everything, get every bit, little bit of information to help him and his dad.
Right, but that doesn't mean... that. What you were implying was that he had been brainwashed in order to, like, stomp out this compassionate kernel, but there was no indication that there was a compassionate kernel.
No, sorry, I don't mean brainwashed in that he started with a compassionate kernel and then his dad stomped it out. I mean that throughout his entire life he's been raised with the goal of learn everything about other people and use that, you know, to your own advantage. But I think that only the first part of it is a Slytherin characteristic, the learn everything about other people. The actually going about using it to your own advantage selfishly, I don't think that's a unique Slytherin characteristic, because anyone of the houses can do that with the thing they're best at, right? You can...
No, it's the whole... The Slytherins are the politicians.
Yes, yeah, sort of. I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think Slytherins are the politicians.
Alright, well, we can discuss this later.
Okay.
I still feel majorly just, but I'll take it.
Oh, sorry. Maybe you're Gryffindor Slytherin.
No, I love you. No, I think you are allowed to have opinions, and I completely understand them, and I think you're super cute.
I am going to insist... Till the end, that Slytherin is a good house. Like, there's nothing wrong with Slytherin, man. Slytherin's great. So, anyways. And Gryffindor is the tricksters. That's for sure.
No, they're not.
Fred and George, come on now.
No. That's pranksters.
Pranksters, that's what I meant.
That's different. And Fred and George are not they are the exception. Because nobody else is like that.
Oh, come on. Dumbledore? He messes with Harry constantly. Gryffindor, it's not that they're... Sorry, you're right. It's not tricksters so much. It's that they just have so much fun with playing around.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, like, that's a core trait. And you obviously have that. You know, it's
yes,
just,
I do.
It's just like, you like doing things and seeing what happens and, you know.
Yeah, I agreed. Absolutely.
So that's the Gryffindor. That's why Fred and George are in Gryffindor.
So I'm not brave or anything.
They are also brave, but the thing is, it's Gryffindor in the methods world isn't so much bravery as heroism.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So, they're obviously related, but it's a little bit, you know.
Good point.
So, all right, anyways, let's continue. I'm totally going to make a comment about the next line. Last term, Harry and Ron had helped Gryffindor with the house championship, beating Slytherin for the first time in 7 years. Guess who they also had help from?
Dumbledore.
A very small, mousy-haired boy had been called forward to place the hat on his head. Harry's eyes wandered past him to where Professor Dumbledore, the headmaster, sat watching the sorting from the staff table, his long silver beard and half-moon glasses shining brightly in the candlelight. Several seats along, Harry saw Gilderoy Lockhart, dressed in robes of aquamarine. And there at the end of the table was Hagrid, huge and hairy, drinking deeply from his goblet. "Hang on," muttered Harry to Ron. "There's an empty chair at the staff table. Where's Snape?" Professor Severus Snape was Harry's least favorite teacher. Harry also happened to be Snape's least favorite student. Cruel, sarcastic, and disliked by everybody except the students from his own house, Slytherin, Snape taught potions. He was the stereotypical evil defense against the dark arts professor. "Wait, what?" "Maybe he's ill," said Ron, hopefully.
"Did you put that in there?"
"Maybe."
"That was not nice."
"I love you so much, kitten." "Maybe he's ill," said Ron, hopefully. "Maybe he's left," said Harry, "because he missed out on the Defense Against the Dark Arts job again." "Or he might be sacked," said Ron enthusiastically. "I mean, everyone hates him."
No, he's going to come up behind them."
"Or maybe," said a very cold voice right behind them, "he's waiting to hear why you two didn't arrive on the school train." I don't know how to do Alan Rickman. It's hard. He's got such a great voice.
Well, maybe. No, I can't do it either.
Oh, man, there was a hilarious Onion article. I want to find this.
Murder is legend.
There's an Onion headline. Alan Rickman ends pizza delivery with ominous "so be it." Isn't that great?
Yes.
"I'll have pepperoni. So be it." Okay. Harry spun around. There, in his black robes, rippling in a cold breeze, stood Severus Snape. He was a thin man with sallow skin, a hooked nose, and greasy shoulder-length black hair, and at this moment, he was smiling in a way that told Harry he and Ron were in very deep trouble. "Follow me," said Snape. Not even daring to look at each other, Harry and Ron followed Snape up the steps into the vast, echoing entrance hall, which was lit with flaming torches. A delicious smell of food was wafting from the great hall, but Snape led them away from the warmth and light down a narrow stone staircase and into the dungeons. "In," he said, opening a door halfway down the cold passageway and pointing. They entered Snape's office, shivering. The shadowy walls were lined with shelves of large glass jars, in which floated all manner of revolting things Harry didn't want to know the name of at the moment. The fireplace was dark and empty. Snape closed the door and turned to look at them. And I think we'll stop there. I hope you like that, my kitchen boo. And I'm glad that we're getting to bed early tonight so you can get a good night's sleep. I love you so much, kitten. And I'll see you real soon. Super.